how should we view grace versus free will? What about predestination versus human freedom? Or grace versus human merit? The 13th and 14th centuries witnessed significant new schools of thought.
These issues became increasingly technically discussed, and the theologians had great divides amongst themselves. This was a very creative period, but not a period where there was necessarily great agreement.
Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Saturday. I'm Lee Webb. Dr. W. Robert Godfrey joins us again to continue his series on church history. Dr. Godfrey is a Ligonier Teaching Fellow and President Emeritus and Professor Emeritus of Church History at Westminster Seminary, California. We've been studying the Middle Ages over the past several weeks, and as we pick up the series today, Dr. Godfrey concentrates on the talented scholastics who appeared and dramatically shaped Christian thought. We're making his entire series available to you, 73 lessons on 12 DVDs. I'll let you know how you can request those with your gift of any amount at the end of the program. But right now, let's join Dr. Robert Godfrey.
We're continuing to look at the period that we're calling the working out of the Middle Ages. We looked at the warm-up and then the wondrous century, and now we're continuing to look at the working out of the remarkable accomplishments of the Middle Ages. And in this session, we want to try to look at an amazing period of theological creativity. What we want to do is see this wonderful period of creativity theologically from about 1250 to about 1350. So a century of an amazing number of very thoughtful theologians with an amazing, creativity of spirit and theological accomplishment. Part of what sparked this creativity, I think, was the recovery of Aristotle. Aristotle had not been very completely known. The West possessed only limited of Aristotle's works in translation. But Aristotle suddenly became known just before this period with new translations, largely from contact with Arabic scholars. And the intellectual stimulus that Aristotle brought to the doing of theology led to a remarkable period, led also in part to the building of universities. This is the period where universities in the West first have their beginning. This is a period in which theology begins to move out of the monastery and into the universities. It still is largely Franciscans and Dominicans who are teaching, but now the university is a whole new center of activity and of reflection. And as we look at theology very, very briefly, what we'll discover is there are certain crucial issues that the theologians are dealing with. We already talked about this briefly relative to Anselm, but a key underlying issue is what's the relationship of faith to reason? And what's the relationship of revelation to reason? How are we going to balance these claims of authority? This became particularly important for Thomas Aquinas because the excitement of the recovery of Aristotle had led some radical thinkers to suggest maybe we don't really need revelation at all, that reason can give us all that we need, or that revelation teaches one truth, but reason teaches another, the theory of two truths. And Thomas Aquinas opposed this absolutely, and Thomas made the great leap forward of taming Aristotle, we might say, to serve the interests of Christian theology. So faith and reason, reason and revelation, great issues of scholastic theology. But they were not the only issues. If we have Aristotle now as a new tool to think more carefully, to be able to formulate more technically our theology, can we make progress on some of the traditional issues of theology that have been difficult? What about grace and free will? How are we going to relate these things? What about predestination and human freedom? We need to think about these subjects. What about the relationship of grace and human merit? To what extent does God act, and to what extent must we act? And to what extent do we become in our acting meritorious before God? And so these issues became increasingly technically discussed, and the theologians had great divides amongst themselves. This was a very creative period, but not a period where there was necessarily great agreement. Thomas wanted very much to use Aristotle to reinforce fairly traditional Christian ways of thinking in the Middle Ages. And he did that in very remarkable ways. But he also wanted to use Aristotle to advance the cause of theology against what he felt was a tendency in some circles to be too world-denying. Now, in a way, that's slightly ironic. Thomas Aquinas, as a young man, had joined the Dominican order against the advice of his family, who thought the Dominicans were a bunch of crazies. And Thomas himself was very much drawn to the ascetic life, to the monastic life. And yet he realized there was a real danger for Christians to become so otherworldly that they denied the reality of this world and the value of this world. One of the works that Thomas wrote was called the Summa Contra Gentiles, the theological summary against the pagans, against the Gentiles. And in that, he was wrestling with this question, how important is creation? How important should we take creation? Because there were some radical monastics who said, salvation is all we should ever think about. Creation doesn't mean anything. Only salvation is what we think about. And Thomas wrote in there, they hold a plainly false opinion who say that in regard to the truth of religion, it does not matter what a man thinks about the creation, so long as he has the correct opinion concerning God. An error concerning creation ends as false thinking about God. So he said, we can't divorce these things. God created the world. God gave us reason. God created us in His image to live for Him, and therefore we can't just ignore the creation work of God and try to think about heaven and salvation. God wants us to think about all these things and integrate these things. And the way that Thomas moved towards that integration was to think about nature and to think about grace. God has created nature, and man in nature, and certainly in the fall, needs grace to complete him. And one of the ways in which Thomas expressed this was to say, grace does not destroy nature, but perfects nature. And so Thomas wanted to integrate nature and grace and to show how what God gave us in creation is rightly related to what God gives us in salvation. These things are not opposed, but they are interconnected. And that led Thomas to a variety of formulations. One of them was that even at creation, man needed grace. Adam was created and given a nature, but that nature, even before the fall, needed grace to direct it, to motivate it, to sustain it. That would be controversial later in the Reformation. The Reformers would tend to reject such a notion. But this was Thomas's effort to bring those things together and to stress nature and grace need to be held together. Thomas was born about 1225 in Italy. His father was a count, so he came from a noble family, an important family, a wealthy family. And as I said, they didn't really want him running off to become a mendicant, but he was insistent and particularly wanted to be very well educated and received a great education, a man of a very remarkable talent, a man who wrote a great deal about angels. That's why he came to be known as the angelic doctor, not because of his nature, although he is a nice guy, but because he had written so much about angels. When he was in his studies, he was often called by his fellow students the dumb ox. And that was true because he was a big guy and he was very quiet. He didn't say a lot, listened a lot, learned a lot. And out of that then came to be a very thoughtful, very crucial theologian, and wanted to stress the reasonableness of Christianity, wanted to talk about the mind of God and how the mind of God was reflected in creation and in salvation, and how we needed to think God's thoughts after him and understand God in that way. His was a great accomplishment, and many would say his summary of theology, his Summa Theologiae, was the high point of medieval theology and medieval teaching. The intriguing thing to me as a historian is that while in looking back we see how great the work of Thomas was, how sophisticated and accomplished his theology was, but he attracted very few followers in the Middle Ages. Theology rather quickly, right after Thomas, moved in a somewhat different direction. We'll come back and talk about that. But that's intriguing to me, that for all of his accomplishment, he did not create immediately a significant school of followers. Thomas, in fact, has gone through a number of revivals since his own time. So in the 16th century, in the face of the Protestant Reformation, there was a great revival of Thomism in the Roman Catholic Church, as Thomas seemed a more helpful guide to refuting Protestants than other late medieval theologians. And again, in the late 19th and in the 20th century, there's been a revival of Thomism in the Roman Catholic Church. So Thomas is a sort of perennial theologian. He keeps coming back and was a towering figure. And Thomas would have said, and in many ways it was true, that he was a very Augustinian theologian. He valued Augustine as any theologian in the Middle Ages did, but Thomas really understood Augustine in all sorts of ways. And when you read Thomas on predestination, you discover that he is a consistent predestinarian. He is an Augustinian predestinarian. But what sometimes comes as a surprise to us as Calvinists is that for many medieval Augustinians, as passionate as they were about teaching the doctrine of predestination, they would teach the doctrine of predestination and say, now that's all true, that's what God does for our salvation, but of course none of us can know whether we're elect or not. So having said God saves only the elect, then they move on to say, but of course we don't know if we're elect or not, so you've got to work as hard as you can work, because you can never actually be sure whether you're one of the elect. For Calvinists, for good Calvinists, election is a really comforting doctrine. We can know that God has elected us and we're in his love and care. Predestination didn't work like that for Augustinians in the Middle Ages. And so, having said the right things about predestination, then Thomas goes on to preach, as we might say, more like an Arminian. That is, the stress is you have to become as holy as you can, because in the end of the day, God accepts the lovable. We need to become lovable because God loves the lovable. That's the task set before Christians. And that's why, as Thomas and others thought about justification, what they said is, well, of course we are justified by faith. And this is why sometimes people can read medieval theologians and say, well, that sounds sort of Protestant. You know, we're saved by faith, we're justified by faith. But what they wanted to say is that we are justified by faith formed by love. And again, we might say, well, that's sort of what the Bible says, isn't it? That faith is formed by love and faith works by love. Isn't that all sort of the same thing? Well, here we need to remember that we are using the word formed in the Aristotelian sense. This is Aristotle living among us again. And for Aristotle, the form is what gives life to the object. So Aristotle would say, Thomas would say, the body is formed by the soul. That's a parallel statement. The body is formed by the soul. Now, he doesn't mean by that the body is shaped by the soul. He means the body is given life by the soul. If you have a body without a soul, you have a corpse. There's no life there because the form has left. The life-giving element has left. And so when Thomas and many of the medievals say faith is formed by love, what they mean is faith is made alive by love. Faith for Thomas is only information in the head until it's joined by love. And then it comes alive and is enlivening. So faith in the Middle Ages, by and large, meant just information that we had received and said was true. But it doesn't transform us. It doesn't enliven us. It's love that does that. And that's why, for the Middle Ages, love is where the action is, not faith. In fact, you don't even really need to know much. You don't need to have much faith information to be saved. That's why they could talk about implicit faith. What do you believe? It was fine in the Middle Ages, still fine in a lot of Roman Catholic circles, just to say, I believe whatever the church believes. I don't know what the church believes, but whatever the church believes, that's what I believe. Maybe you've had the experience of talking to Roman Catholics and finding out they don't know a lot about what they believe, and then you say, well, don't you care about that? And the fundamental answer is, no, I don't need to know this stuff. The church knows it. So I explicitly or implicitly have the faith of the church, but what is saving is not this faith. I mean, I hold to that. That's important. That's the first step. But what's really saving is that I'm made a new person by love. I'm renewed by love. I'm sanctified, we would say. And that's why the classic Roman Catholic formulation, and still articulated in many ways by the theologians of the Middle Ages, is, I am sanctified in order that I may be justified. I have to be filled with a certain level of love to be made lovely, to be justified. The Augustinian theologians, like Aquinas and others, said, that happens by grace, ultimately. God accomplishes that in his elect sovereignly, but it still has to happen. It still will happen. And this is where the sacraments come in. The sacraments build up our love. The sacraments provide almost a quantity of grace that makes us different. This is what Thomas and others were talking about, and the general range of discussion that would continue right down to Luther and Calvin's day. Now, Thomas's achievement was remarkable, but as I said, rather short-lived. Almost immediately after Thomas, who died in 1274, a new school of thought arose that came to be called nominalism. Thomas's approach to theology, actually more to philosophy, was called realism. And the later school of theology came to be called nominalism, again from a rather narrow philosophical part of the two schools. But the newer theology became much more interested in the will of God than in the mind of God. And rather than thinking about how nature and grace were held together in a kind of reasonable way, as Thomas had done, the newer theology suddenly is fascinated with the will of God and the freedom of God. And the focus then is not on the reasonableness of what God has done, but it's on the freedom of God to do whatever he wants to do, and that therefore, whatever he has done, he could have done something very different. And this nominalism, sort of foreshadowed by a theologian by the name of Duns Scotus, and then coming to a more radical expression by William of Ockham, wants to stress that God is free to do whatever he wants. And this new theology is constantly speculating about what could God have done? Could God have incarnated the Logos in a rock for our salvation? Now, no one was suggesting that God was going to do that or that God had ever thought about doing that. The question was purely a question, would God have been free to do that? And the older theology, as we find it in Thomas or in Anselm, would have been inclined to say, no, that's not reasonable. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't apply to the situation. But the newer theology wanted to say, yes, God is radically free. He could have done anything. And the effect of that was to tend to say, we can't have a natural theology. We can't reason from nature to God, because nature doesn't reflect God, as Thomas tended to think, but nature is radically independent of God. Nature doesn't tell us anything about God, because God could have made nature entirely differently. We could have walked on our arms instead of our legs. You can't do any reasoning from nature, because it was so crucial to them to talk about the absolute freedom of God, the utter transcendence of God. And in this new nominalist theology, the curious thing is that some of them tended in a more Augustinian direction. The freedom of God exalted the sovereignty of God and meant that he was absolutely sovereign and in control of salvation. But others of them, like William of Ockham, tended in a more Pelagian direction, saying the freedom of God was to give man freedom. And so it's very much up to the freedom of our will, what we do with grace, and how we accomplish it. So this new theology was vital, was creative, was energetic and intriguing, but moved theology away from Thomas, fascinated on this question of freedom, and then began increasingly popularly to talk about human freedom in salvation. Salvation is up to you. It depends on how you use your will. You have to have some grace. But you know, you get grace in baptism, makes you a new creature. And now you're a new creature. What are you going to do with your new creatureliness? Are you going to live for God or you're not going to live for God? That's up to you. And these theologians, some of them, then, like William of Ockham, moved increasingly away from Augustine. They would have still said they were Augustinian, but they really have moved away from a theology centered on grace and more focused on human will, human freedom, human responsibility. It's not entirely unlike some of the history of Protestantism, where you had Calvinists and then you had later Arminians who became more and more radical, so that you had revivalists who would say radical things like, God voted for you and the devil's voted against you. You have to cast the deciding ballot. Well, that's terrible theology, and the nominalists wouldn't have been quite that bad. But there's this direction, you see. And what it reminds us again is how complex medieval theology was, how it pulled in a variety of directions. Sometimes we look back at the Middle Ages from a Protestant point of view and say, well, they were just all semi-Pelagian. No, they weren't all semi-Pelagian. There were some who were really great Augustinians. There were some who were semi-Pelagian and some who moved in a really rather Pelagianizing, rather radical direction. But all of them didn't get faith right. None of them really understood what Luther would discover about faith. All of them tended to think, whether by my free action or by the grace of God, I need to be changed by love to be acceptable to God. Now, the Augustinians said the elect will be changed by love, by God's gracious action, but you need to be changed by love. This is not a Protestant world of thought. This is a world of thought that allows sanctification to stand before justification. So we can say we can learn amazing things from the scholastics. And you can pick up Thomas Aquinas and read him to great profit in any number of areas of theology. But even at its best, the medieval theology was not able to break through to a genuinely biblical understanding of faith. That would really wait for the coming of the Reformation.
The 13th and 14th centuries witnessed a growing tension between revelation, reason, and faith. Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind and Dr. Robert Gottfried's series, A Survey of Church History. He's been taking us through the development of the church from the apostolic era and now into the Middle Ages. Here on the Saturday program, we'll continue this series right up to the present day. As we celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, we're reminded why understanding church history is so important. So for your gift of any amount, we'd like to send you Dr. Gottfried's series, 73 Lessons on 12 DVDs. Make your request at renewingyourmind.org or call us at 800-435-4343. We think these DVDs will be a great addition to your library. So again, let me repeat our contact information. Our phone number is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. This Renewing Your Mind program is just one element of Ligonier Ministries' outreach. Another is RefNet, our 24-hour internet radio station. You'll find teaching, news, music, audiobooks, and more. And you can listen right now when you go to refnet.fm or when you download the free RefNet app. Well, next Saturday, Dr. Godfrey takes us into the 15th century and critiques a practice known as mysticism. There were those who advocated a Christian life that was driven more by the heart than by the head. So join us next weekend for Renewing Your Mind.